When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This is our Season 2 wrap-up for Electric Boogaloo, so we'll depart from the usual format. We're not going to be covering a chapter. I'll include a short interview with Arthur Jamfa. Arthur is at the London School of Economics. He specializes in international relations with emphasis in Chinese. So he's a student of Chinese and geography and economics and international relations. He's also just a really funny guy, and I've enjoyed talking with him. Arthur and I started corresponding about ethnicity and ethnic constructs in Game of Thrones, and I thought that they were interesting enough that maybe we ought to include it for a wider listenership. So that's about a 20-minute interview with Arthur, and then we'll do about 45 minutes with Steve, where we answer listener feedback and get his take on some of the news relative to new Game of Thrones content. Just a warning, if you have kids in the rooms, there are certain elements of the Steve portion that you might not want to have the kids in the room for. Just a heads up about that. Finally, in the Bird's Eye View section, I'll reflect a little bit on the listener feedback that I got relative to my recent survey about the shape of Electric Boogaloo going forward. So this will be the last Electric Boogaloo for a few weeks. If you're not caught up, go ahead and get caught up to Chapter 20. So in a few weeks, we'll be back with Chapter 20, and Steve and I will begin our coverage of Season 3. Without further ado, here is Boseman Aeron.
Ask Aeron anything!
Aeron, what is the Three Right Turns episode that you feel most proud of?
Oh, man. I don't know.
Well, you're thinking about, I'm going to tell you.
None of them.
You did one early 2020.
Uh-huh.
Like something about the unbearable whiteness of being.
Yeah, that's right up there.
I thought that was really good. As far as a white guy talking about whiteness, I think you did your homework on that. Really worth a listen.
I think that's one of the ones I'm proud of because I feel like it's one of the most me. Like it's like unique, you know, talking about my German-American, heritage and Jim's Italian-American heritage and historical white. Like honestly, that's like one of the things that like I was digging out material that I've been thinking about for like 10 years, because that was one of the things that really started flipping my opinion from like, hey, you know, we're living in a post-racist society and there's just a lot of people that are whining about stuff, to like, oh, shit. No, actually, that's a complete pants on head take and I'm way wrong, both historically and in terms of current politics. But I also like if. I think Don't Blame Me, I Voted Al. I think that's a really good takedown of like first past the post voting.
I have to check that one out. I don't think I remember that one.
Yeah, that one I thought was pretty solid too. But yeah,
Swiss Bold Network, everyone.
If you want to
go check it out, SwissBold.com.
Unbridled political thoughts. Yep.
If you have a question for Aeron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
London School of Economics.
That's me, yeah.
And how long have you been in London? And Chinese, yeah.
And Chinese, yeah. So Chinese is half my degree. China, the culture, the history, the language.
Mm-hmm. Just really simple stuff.
Easy. Yeah, honestly. Easy. It's not tiring at all. It's not a lot of work. You know, it's understanding.
Yeah, so how long have you lived in London?
I've lived in London for half my life, on and off. So I've lived half my life in France and half my life in the UK, because I'm French as well.
So were you born in France?
No. So I was born in the UK. Then I moved straight back to France. Then I moved back to UK and I moved back to France and I'm back. So I've gone forward and back.
So you are an international. You are an international man of mystery.
Absolutely. That's how I got into my degree. I told them how multicultural I was.
So yeah, all right. So let's talk a little bit about Game of Thrones. So
yeah.
I was fascinated by your email because my approach, and maybe because this is because I'm in the field of religious studies, is to look at the differences between North and South in terms of either culture or religion or like class difference. Mm-hmm. And you suggested that maybe we ought to be thinking about this in terms of ethnicity too.
Yeah. So I was just really interested in an idea that because I was really exploring the stories of the first men and the story about the Rhoynar coming over. And the fact that there is very much a different ethnicity between the central kingdoms and then the northern kingdoms, well, northern kingdom and then Dawn. And so I was thinking, what if there's something more than just class? An idea that they really have a different ethnic identity. And that really means that there is a sense that they can't really respect an ethnic identity that is to them inferior to themselves. And so they kind of have a disregard for the lives of the Northerners. They can't really respect that a Northerner has been made hands. Perhaps that's been overcome between the friendship between Robert and Ned. But that the others who have not had that one-on-one contact with Northerners still think them as inferior ethnically because they come from a previous ethnicity or previous race.
I don't even think that Ned and Robert have really overcome their differences.
No, perhaps not. Perhaps not. But he still makes him the hand, which surely must mean that, you know, he doesn't think that he's useless.
Yeah, I think there's something about Robert that, for whatever reason, he perceives Ned to be like a, I don't know, like a lesser version of himself, which makes him like a good drinking buddy or something.
Yes, that is
but
true.
I don't really even feel like he knows Ned.
No, that is the most mind-boggling part of Ned and Robert's relationship, isn't it? It's that although they seem so close and they seem to have had such a tight relationship, it's almost like they don't know each other. They keep expecting things from one another that really you can't really expect from one another.
Exactly.
Yeah, Robert's like, "Come on, come drink and lay with all these girls," and then Ned is like, "Let's do the righteous thing." It's like, guys, I feel like you should have figured this out.
So I think the strongest part of your case here, Arthur, is probably Dorne, and part of this relates to your email got me thinking about this. Part of this relates to the geography, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because not only do we have in Dorne sort of this Rhoynish shared history, shared memory of a common ancestor, or common homeland, and the stories that they tell each other, but they're geographically separate enough so that they've been able to keep their ethnic identity somewhat distinct from the rest of Westeros.
Absolutely. And for me, that kind of came from the fact that the first way I approached it was, what if there's some kind of racial hierarchy going on here that makes the Northerners inferior? And it was really interesting, your response, which was, well, the Andals are inspired from Greek and Roman ancestry, and they didn't really have a race as an idea. They had phenotypes, but that isn't race.
Yeah, I think my point, I'm not even sure. I'm still sort of working this out. I was kind of looking forward to this conversation to work some of this out. But I mean, I think that any ethnic studies department that you go to, you'll probably get it hammered into your head that race is a modern construct.
Absolutely.
But there's always been social constructs that have defined hierarchy and class and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
So then the question is, okay, so before these pseudoscientists in, the 18th and 19th centuries were, got on about race, how did the ancient world think in terms of the difference between the way people looked?
Mm.
And with the Romans in particular, and borrowing this from the Greeks, they were really interested in, like, for the most part, facial features.
Mm, yeah.
You know, like you could trust someone with, like someone had large eyes. It's all bullshit. But if you have large eyes, then, you're trustworthy. But if you have beady little eyes, then you can't trust that guy. It's all stupid.
I mean, it's quite logical, isn't it?
But it's not any more or less stupid than, skin tone or whatever.
Absolutely
right?
Not. So, absolutely not. A little bit of that, don't we? We have red hair, right?
Absolutely.
So with red hair, doesn't have sword. Yeah. That's the closest we get to it, don't we?
Well, and we still have carryovers of phenotypes. I think that there is still something about, like, beady eyes, can't trust that. There's still a little bit of that. It's not as dominant as sort of this perception of race, but so for the ancients, and I guess, I don't know, I don't want to push the analogy too much, but, Martin has said that the Andals are basically modeled after Rome, and there's several indications that that's the case. So how did the Romans perceive these differences in how people looked? Well, what they did was they compared them to animals. So if you looked more like a lion, then we will lionize you. Really stupid. Or like Caligula. Like Caligula looked like a goat, so he must have had the moral ineptitude of a goat, which of course
is the famous moral ineptitude of a goat.
Which, I mean, that's a lot of shade to throw on a goat, why are goats better than lions?
I mean, why are donkeys stubborn?
So I think part of this is sort of this carryover of these Greek ideas of what we call physiognomy. And they were, these were like people's best ideas about how to judge someone's character. But I guess the point here is that you could find differences in phenotypes, even in family groups.
Absolutely, yeah.
So even if, like, you know, you couldn't, like, for some reason the Greeks didn't like extreme. So if you were too pale, then that spoke badly about it, your character. Or if you're too dark, that spoke badly about your character. But so if you're like this nice shade of coffee or whatever, then that was the ideal. But you could even get that between two siblings. You could get a lighter skinned or a darker skinned, or someone with beady eyes or someone bigger eyes, even within siblings.
That kind of ties into what we said about the sisters, right? The Stark sisters.
Yeah, Sansa and Arya, right?
Yeah, Sansa and Arya, right? One of them is described as having a horse face. And
poor being, Arya.
And you know, having northern traits, but the other one is pretty and has southern traits. So they are sisters.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're dealing with in these chapters how people perceive Arya. Mm-hmm. And one thing that my co-author Aaron has pointed out a lot, and I really do appreciate, is that in one sense, Arya is kind of ridiculed because she's got like a horse face, which I guess we're supposed to think is more northern. Another way to think of this is that she looks a lot like Lyanna, and Arya, and Lyanna is supposed to be this great beauty. And so it's a question of this isn't really a question of beauty as much as this is a question of the perception of northern identity versus southern identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is an idea that the central kingdoms kind of have an, if we can call this, an ethnic identity that is more unified than the other kingdoms. Because no one's saying, oh, look, this person looks like someone from the Riverlands and this like someone from the Stormlands. And so to go back to talk about geography, I was kind of thinking about, well, before this whole idea of social Darwinism and the idea that the construction of race, how was ethnicity defined, right? And for me, it was defined by geographical features, but so like an idea of ancestry, which is more defined by whichever warlord came in and controlled your space, than anything about genetics. But yeah, so I mean, there's really good examples of that in real life, right? You've got in Spain, you've got like the Basque Country that kept their language for a really long time and kept like a separate identity. My own ancestry, the Bagante people in Cameroon. The Bagante people have an identity that is defined by the fact that the Bagante people lived in the hills. And so they were really hard to invade. No one could invade them. Hmm. And there was a big battle in like 1687 where they tried to invade them. And then this warlord called Alakru pushed them back. And so he is the great ancestor of the Bagante people today. And so you could really find that duality of ancestry and geographical separation that you also find with like the Welsh that didn't get invaded by the Anglo-Saxon or the Scottish that didn't get invaded by the Romans, where like the Cornish are considered as English, even though really they're just as far apart from the rest of England than Wales.
So it's like the stories we tell about sort of the origin stories tell you something about the people in general. Like for instance, you know, your people are, you know, unbent, unbroken or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just a story. You know, it's part of the ethnicity, but it is part of the constructed part of the ethnicity.
Right. I mean, for example, the story of the Bagante people is actually of the Babru people, to be even more precise, is that the people tried to invade the Babu people in 1687, and this warlord called Alakru told all his soldiers to have fog come out of their penises. And supposedly that made the area foggy. And that's how they won the war. So
that's good.
You can't get more constructed than that, really.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm from San Francisco, which is famously foggy, so I wonder if there's something going on there too.
I mean, you never know. You might have to look into it. And did anyone consider this before?
Not before now. That's really great. That's really great. So, all right. So here's my thinking.
Yeah.
just like applied to like Sansa and Arya. I think that there's something about Catelyn that thinks, well, Sansa's really going to thrive in the South.
Yeah.
There's just something about, and I don't know if it's like, if it's just about her sort of ability to be a proper lady or whatever, but she looks Southern, right?
Yeah.
Like Sansa looks more Southern, and there's something about that that maybe convinces Catelyn that she's thinking, well, that's that she belong. She really belongs in a place like King's Landing, which is totally wrong. Like Sansa's horrible in King's Landing. Like, she has a she has a horrible life. She's just a pawn for everyone. She gets pushed around.
Can't do politics.
Yeah, but for some reason, Catelyn just thinks that that's where she belongs. And I wonder if there isn't something about sort of, yeah, she's got those Southern facial features.
Yeah, and I think and maybe in the way that she's treated compared to the rest of the family when they go South, maybe you can have hints that actually she's considered, okay, we can keep her betrothed to the king. And would they have done that if it was she looked like Arya? I mean, we don't know, right? But perhaps there is a sense that because she looks Southern, not only did her mother consider, oh, she'll be fine in the South because she looks like them, but also maybe they treated them better than maybe her father.
But, you know, some of this is carryover from history, right? I think that by George studying history, he's going to bring in all kinds of unconscious baggage from sort of a Eurocentric view of history. And then some of it you think, well, maybe this is a conscious effort by the author. I mean, if you think about like the way that the Dothraki are described in the book, it's very much sort of like, this is how Western people would perceive an Asian nomadic warlord. So you really have that sort of Eurocentrism in that way. And I think sometimes Martin is very conscious of it. I think he's very conscious of the way that he's describing the Dothraki. I don't know how much this sort of northern-southern stuff actually goes into the way he's separating out these cultures. Do you think that this is an intention on his part? Or do you think this is sort of this unconscious baggage that Europe had and so Game of Thrones has to have?
I think it probably is unconscious. I don't think that he is trying to separate identities in this way. I think he just has an understanding of geopolitics. When he wrote Game of Thrones, he had an understanding of geopolitics that was very much etched in the 90s. And he took that knowledge on, and then he took that understanding about how identity is shaped with features. But I'm not sure that that pushes into him trying to create a separate, like a racial hierarchy in Game of Thrones. I don't think that's what he's doing. I think he's kind of doing this unconsciously by toying with the ideas of identity and geography that we had at that time, and kind of leads him to the same conclusion that we realize now it leads you to, which is probably an uncomfortable one.
That's really well said. Arthur, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, Steve, we are wrapping up season two here.
And oh, what a season it was.
Oh, man, this was the doozy. This was a doozy.
The thing is that this it really is something like the sophomore season.
Yeah, there's always a slump there, right?
You got a potential for the slump, but man, we're cooking.
If ever a show had a potential for a slump, it's like, yeah, you just killed your main character's dummy.
Yeah, right now, what do you do?
Of course, there's going to be a slump.
Well, yeah, because then there's still the, like, now maybe the cynicism factor goes up. The benefit of the doubt goes down. So you're not, yeah, you're like, well, okay, I don't know if I can trust you, right? I mean, the trust is the issue, I think. So well, it's no, you know, a small task to try to do what they just did. And it's impressive.
So, Steve, last week I had Kim Renfro on the podcast because there was quite a bit of news in the Game of Thrones fandom. And you may have seen a little bit of this news online. I know that you're active on social media. I'm not so much, but... Yeah.
And I'm trying to avoid spoilers, of course. So it's hard to
get... Yeah, of course.
To even when you start dealing with... you know, news of prequels. It's like, well, there could be a reference here and there, you know. Mm-hmm.
You find out, spoiler alert, Jon Snow will get a haircut at one point in the future.
Just
see? Ruin it for you.
Not ready for that.
Part of the news is that George got a big old fat payday to consider a few other possible HBO prequel projects. So here's my hope.
That he finishes his other stuff?
He's not going to do that. Like, really, no one thinks he's going to finish.
Baller move, man. Baller move. No. Just, yeah, I'd like to work on stuff before the thing that I haven't finished.
I mean, he's getting so much money, he could buy like 9 different authors. Just buy them. Could be like The Running Man, where only the best of the 9 survive. That's how much money he's getting. Here's what I'm going to do, Steve. I'm going to give you the concept for each of 5 projects. Now, this is not, there's not only 5 projects. There's more projects, but I've narrowed it to 5. We're calling this the War of 5 projects.
All right.
I want to talk about each, and I want you to give me like what you would like to see. What would this project need to include in order to draw your interest?
Okay,
here's project number 1. Project number 1 is in the works. They're filming this right now. This is happening. It's called House of the Dragon. And here's my 3-sentence synopsis. The Targaryen kings and queens are at the height of their power. They got 15 dragons and all kinds of drama between brothers and sisters. But can these dragon lords stave off civil war long enough to keep the dynasty going? So... as we've noted, you're going to get lots of Game of Thrones staples like dragons and incest and whatnot.
Well, see, that's the thing. My first thought is no dragons. Call it House of Dragons. Talk about Dragon Lord. You never see the dragons. Dragons are like Vera from Cheers.
I like it. Or, a lot of talk about them.
Or.
Can I see a shadow every now and again?
Or it's all dragons done in the style of the old sitcom Dinosaurs. I want big old puffy dragons like dinosaurs, and it's them. It's like they're going to work, and like the dragon lords are like their bosses, and they're just
talking about. For those of you who don't remember, imagine like a Imagine like a sports mascot who has this, a family at home. Like, let's say a dinosaur mascot. Like, you're at the Rockies game. And the dinosaur mascot, like, goes home but doesn't take off the costume. Right. What do you even call it? It's not, like, claymation. What? It was just a costume, right?
Yeah, it was like Bear in the Big Blue House.
It was...
Or King of Queens.
Bear in the Big Blue Dragon House.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like that idea, right? I mean, it's you know, full laugh track, whole thing. Just, I mean, obviously still incest. Because you got to know your audience.
Yeah, if they could just film House of the Dragon as like an 80s sitcom, that would work.
It's, I love it.
And you could actually call it King of Queens if you want to. All right, second project. This is happening. It's a Broadway show, Steve.
Is it a musical?
I don't know, but I hope so. Okay, so here's my synopsis. This is a Broadway play. It features a younger Ned Stark, his sister Lyanna, and her betrothed Robert Baratheon. It's set at a tournament at Harrenhal, where a 15-year-old prodigy, Jaime Lannister, wins his way into the Kingsguard, the youngest knight ever to do so. And this, of course, enrages his father, because Kingsguards cannot inherit land or titles. Mm.
Yeah, definitely, definitely in, and it has to be Nathan Lane as 15-year-old Jaime Lannister.
Nathan Lane is like 60 years old.
He's a genius. He'll figure it out.
A lot of makeup.
Surprisingly, none. Just everybody else is the
appropriate. Can I get Matthew Broderick as Tywin?
I would love that, right? I mean, it'd be even better if it was like almost like a Look Who's Talking type situation where like the 15-year-old, they have an actor, but it's voiced by Nathan Lane the whole time.
All right. Okay. So, and if it could be a musical, I mean,
it would be. Have you ever seen a Broadway play?
Yeah. I mean, I like Les Mis. I like Hamilton. I like, as a kid, I really loved the television production of The Music Man. Did you ever see that?
No.
Fiddler on the Roof. I'm a big fan.
Have you seen these live?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the best I did for Hamilton was I saw a live performance in San Francisco.
Okay.
You're not a big Broadway guy.
I don't know if I've ever seen a play outside of a high school play.
Really? Okay. Well, is it the musical thing? Are you into? Do you have something against musicals?
It's, I don't want people on stage to even inadvertently make eye contact with me.
Do you feel that way? I feel that way at a comedy club. I feel like if I'm going to go into a comedy club, there's no way I'm sitting in the front row.
Yeah, no, I get that. And like, and I understand. I mean, I've done that. I've picked on people a little bit and from the stage. But it's like, if the medium is such that it's like, yeah, it's you and a guy and you know it's that guy, right? But like, I mean, if you're up there going, hey, it's not, it's interesting, like, hey, this guy's doing comedy and this guy thinks he's Pippin.
So, yeah, I mean, let's just talk about the rules of the comedy club. If I go into a comedy club and I sit in the front row, I should just expect at some point I'm going to have to talk to the guy on stage.
Yeah, I mean, I would at least prepare yourself for the, it could simply be a rhetorical type situation where you just, you know, yeah, you're already, the burden at a minimum is you shouldn't go to the bathroom during the set, because I'll talk about how you're pooping the entire time you're gone.
Sure. Now, is there a, am I safe anywhere in the club? Like if I sit midway back, or at what point am I safe?
I think if you have a pretty good sense of where the light, like if it's a pretty well lit spotlight type situation, you become a silhouette. So that's the other part of the reason why. I mean, not only is it the proximity of the people in the front row, but that also can be the sight range for the performer, because if the spotlight is proper, you're probably pretty blind to most of the room.
Yeah, so you could be safe if you're unseen.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I'm in a better mood. I'm like, yeah, fine. If they want to do crowd work, I'll play along. But sometimes I don't want to be in, I'm not in the mood. I just want to sit there and laugh.
Yeah, no, I get you.
I guess what I'm trying to say, Steve, is fuck you.
Okay, that's fair.
All right, next project. This is called Nine Voyages. Now, I've not filmed any pilot for this. This is just a possibility.
Okay.
Lord Corlys Velaryon, a.k.a. the Sea Snake, is played by Steve Toussaint. Corlys is as daring as he is wealthy. He swashbuckles his way from sea to sea and into the heart of every woman he meets. And maybe a few fanboys, too.
So is this a character we see in the series? This one, currently?
This is a character that we have not met, but we will meet this character in House of the Dragon. So they are planning a spinoff
of a
show that hasn't even aired yet.
Whoa.
That's how confident they are about this guy.
This would be like if there was a big Ragu show.
Laverne and Shirley, a spinoff
of Happy Days, and then Carmine gets his own.
This is even before there was a Laverne and Shirley. That they would, I say, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do the Big Ragu. Not as a child, as an old man. Oh. They're going to call him.
I just figured this was going in the young Sheldon type. Just the young Ragu.
Beyond Ragu. Beyond. It's everyone that.
The Big Carmine Ragu. Multiverse.
Yes. It's like Better Call Ragu. It's like all about the minimal characters around Laverne and Shirley.
It's like Multiplicity. It's just Carmine in different scenarios simultaneously.
I got a little bit of fan mail for you, Steve. I got someone saying, I'm so excited that Steve used the Chachi reference, comparing Chachi to Danny. I sent it to my friend, telling him that I'm not the only one that makes this association.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
I like that one.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, okay, so nine Voyages sounds pretty sexy. Probably should be called Nine and a Half Voyages.
So that's all they would have to do?
Yeah, just make it super, just get it erotic, and I'm in.
All right. So next one is, again, keeping with the nautical theme, this one is called 10,000 Ships.
Okay.
A millennia before the War of the Five Kings, a princess named Nymeria leads her people into exile. They sail from island to island until they finally land in southern Westeros. Now, I'm excited about anything with ships. You know that.
I know.
You know that about me.
This seems like almost, I almost seem like too much for you.
Too much ships? Like, I mean, the 10,000. There's 10,000. Yeah.
Like, I mean, I could see you, like, this is just like an overload, right? Like, I mean, you think you're a fan of anything until you get too much of it.
So it's like maybe on episode 2, I'm thinking, I thought I was going to like this many ships. Yeah, but like
4,500 ships seems more doable.
So you're saying decrease the ship count.
Yeah.
And you're in.
They're setting themselves up, right? I mean, or I want this to be like, I need Matthew Modine and Gina Davis, like Cutthroat Island.
One thing about ships that I like is that they have names. I like to know the name of the ship.
That's 10,000 names.
That's too many. It's too many names. You're really devaluing the name of any one ship if you have 10,000 of them.
Yeah. I mean, then you have
like, imagine if like the Starship Enterprise was like zipping through space with 10,000 ships.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't care. I wouldn't care what it's called.
Right. It's hard enough to keep track of all these characters. Now I got to keep track of boats? Nah. I might be out on this one.
That's too bad.
I'm not that strong a swimmer, man. We've talked about this. Water makes me nervous.
Okay, this is another show that's a possibility. All we have is the title. We don't know anything else about it. It's called Fleabottom.
Mm-hmm.
We know nothing about this project except for its name. Presumably, it'll be set in the slums of King's Landing, featuring the brothels, bums, and bad boys of the filthiest place in all the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, this has got to be a reality show where they basically recreate Fleabottom, and it's like Survivor, only way more STDs.
And who would you like to see in this?
It's everyday people, dude.
Would you, like to, eventually, would you like to be featured?
Eventually you'll have like a celebrity version, right? Like we've seen that with other reality shows, like a Big Brother. I mean, there's no way you're keeping Corey Feldman out of this.
Corey Feldman is the first person you cast in this.
Yeah, he gets in there and it's just like, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I don't know a ton about Flea Bottom, except it's just, he's constantly luring people in to buy his wares.
I got some questions for you. I got some questions for me. Mm-hmm. You wanna go first? You want me to go first?
I think, did you win first last time? I can go first.
I believe I did. Steve, this first question is from Steve. So this is from Steve to Steve. Oh. Steve, what is something, a hobby, a skill, or a guilty pleasure, etc., you've added during your routine in COVID?
That's a powerful question.
It's a good question, Steve.
Yeah, to my routine. I mean, I think the obvious one for me is mask coordination with the shoes.
Well, this is good to know because I think you have like 37 pairs of shoes, right?
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood, maybe more now. I think things have changed.
So then the question is, do you have that number of masks to match the
shoes? No, but like, so like it depends, right? I mean, I would say less of like, hey, let's coordinate the mask, but let's make sure to not clash, right? Like, So when I'm wearing my Christopher Cross flamingo mask, right, which is essentially the album cover of the self-titled album, which, you know, of course, celebrated, I believe, its 40th anniversary. And I was supposed to go to the Christopher Cross concert, the 40th anniversary concert, but then, you know, wow, COVID canceled that. So that mask is green and it's got some pink on it.
COVID almost canceled Christopher Cross.
It certainly tried, but that guy is a fighter. It's one thing that he's been known for. It's toughness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so like that one, I'm like, I gotta be careful with what I wear, obviously. Because like, I feel like as I've said many times in the past, that the shoes are the punctuation mark to this sentence that is your outfit. So now we've added a little something to the ensemble, right? And I think if you've got a white mask or a black mask, you're probably doing fine. But as soon as you start mixing in the color mask, you have to be considerate of everything that you're doing. I think it's easy to think that masks are this temporary thing because this is not going to be who we are going forward or ad nauseum. But as of right now, it is who you are. And I think you need to show that level of care.
I appreciate that perspective. Now, speaking of someone who like walks around with about two, maybe three pairs of shoes in any given year, I feel like I'm just wearing commas on my feet all the time. But you said it's the punctuation. I don't have a repertoire of punctuation marks.
So your shoes are like everyone's looking at going, and?
And what?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like they're like a misplaced ellipsis, Steve.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. Even a question mark is fine. I think.
I've tried question marks on my feet. They don't work out very well.
I think when people see it and they're like, if you've got people going, huh, that's still a reaction. And I think, but at least it provides some, like now the burden's on them to provide the answer.
All right, so that's good. That's a good answer. I was not anticipating that, but that's interesting.
Do you think it would be more masturbatory?
I don't know how to answer that, and okay, so I won't.
Fair.
This is a question for me. This is from Baton Rouge Billy.
Oh, man, so far so
good. Come on,
Billy.
That's lovely. Baton Rouge Billy.
What a great, I mean, look, I don't want to alienate. I mean, I've already alienated Philadelphia last season, but Baton Rouge is, what does Baton Rouge stand for? Or what does it stand for? What does it mean? How does it translate?
Something red.
Red baton.
Yeah, it means red baton. Everyone knows that, Steve.
Yeah, Baton Rouge. I mean, you can't, it sounds like it sounds like molasses coming off the tongue.
What I would love is that for Baton Rouge Billy to like live in like Topeka.
That's right. He's
never even been to Baton Rouge, but it just sounds badass. All right, so Baton Rouge Billy asks, What would you say is the single most impactful decision made by a single character? The decision that had the greatest consequences for the greatest number of other characters. My vote would be, this is still Baton Rouge Billy registering his vote. My vote would be for Catelyn's decision to capture Tyrion. If she hadn't, Jaime wouldn't have wounded Ned. Ned could have resigned peacefully and gone back up north. Rob never becomes king, never entangles himself with Walder Frey. Arya is never orphaned. Theon never takes Winterfell. And Bran never goes into exile, etc., etc. That's a really strong case, Billy. All that...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, all that wouldn't happen if Catelyn hadn't taken Tyrion. So that's Billy's vote. Here's my answer, Billy. I think I can do you one better. Illyrio gives 3 eggs to Dany. If Dany doesn't get eggs, she doesn't get dragons. She doesn't get dragons. You got nothing. I think dragons are everything. So that's my take, Billy.
Baton Rouge is means French. It means red stick.
Red stick. Well, I wasn't that far off.
No.
Yeah. I think that Billy could have been named for something other than his geography.
Well, if he had just gone by Red Stick Billy, we wouldn't automatically associate him with Baton Rouge, per se.
No, we'd associate him with his stick.
We'd have a lot more questions. Yeah. A lot more questions. It's like, hey, is he an excited dog?
I'm sorry, Billy. I didn't think that.
I'm sorry, Baton Rouge.
I don't think that you thought it was going this direction, and I couldn't stop him. There's no way I can stop it, and it's too funny to cut out. So it's in there.
Oh, man, my poor dogs. a lot of Baton Rouge references.
This is Steve. Speaking of dogs, This is from Walker of Dragons, and this is not a question. It is just a statement that you should hear.
don't drown any more dogs.
Walker Dragon says, Steve, poodles are psychotic. A friend who is a canine geneticist calls them bundles of mental illness. Then again, liking poodles does not surprise me given your gentle sadist persona.
Poodles psychotic? This is wild.
This is
like
from someone who embraces science, Steve.
Yeah, I guess so. This is news to me. But I'll allow it.
Maybe you like the. I think that you like the chaos. How many dogs do you have?
Yeah,
in your house?
That's fair. That's a five dogs. Two of them.
When you have 5 dogs, one of them being psychotic, you're probably not even going to notice.
Well, the thing is Django is. Django's got human eyes. He ain't. We don't treat him like a dog, because that would be folly.
Did you say he has human eyes?
Clearly.
Like in a jar, like he keeps them as a...
in a locket.
As a keepsake?
Nobody that meets Django assumes he's all dog. They assume that there is some sort of a karmic reincarnated punishment going on. And that the way my wife puts it is there is a human in there that was born as a dog, is aware that he's a human as a dog, but can't communicate in any other fashion other than a dog, and still has like dog like desires, but human regret. So even when he's like, I'm going to lick myself in this very upsetting fashion for a long period of time, at the same time, he hates it.
My dog is half poodle, and she won't stop looking at me. And I don't know what she wants to tell me. Like, I'll take her out. She has all of her needs met, but she just wants... I think she would just love it if we could just stare into each other's eyes all day. And I've got other things that I could be doing.
Yeah, you assume it's a gaze. I assume she's
quietly judging me.
She's judging you. She's peering into your soul. There may be something supernatural. Yeah, we have our new poodle kiddo. She's young and she's wild.
Is she psychotic?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know. It's again to your point. Like, I mean, when you have that much chaos, who's to say? And I mean,
you like, and I think you like it. There's a little bit of you that likes the chaos.
I do. I mean, I go to house. Oh my gosh, I go to house with people that have dogs, and they're so boring. I'm like, dude, just eat it. Like, why? Why would you? What? Like, they're like, oh, look at how sweet, and like the dog is dull. Just why? Why would you have a dull dog? Why would you be happy about it?
I'd be so happy with a dull dog. I would be happy with a dog that just wouldn't look at me. just look at something else. Stare at the wall. Just look at something else.
So you want a dog? We want a traumatized dog.
All right.
I'm vexed over this. I guess. My retort was going to be, oh, well, you know, because poodles are highly intelligent. Well, that doesn't necessarily preclude them from being psychotic, though.
Yeah. Oh, I think it probably goes hand in hand.
Yeah. So it could very well be that the reason why I like them is the reason why I shouldn't. Uh-huh. I'll handle it. Name my dog Red Stick Billy next time.
This is a question from Mikael, and this is for me. Over the course of the series, Jamie went from a villain to a gray character with glimpses of heroism. And some would argue one of the more sympathetic characters in the entire story by the end. Could you see a similar arc, however unlikely, with Cersei? Wow. Could Cersei be transformed by George Martin's magic from the person that we know and love to hate to someone that's more sympathetic in the same way that Jamie has been? I think it's possible. I think it's within Martin's talent to do so, although I think it's a tall order and I don't think it'll happen. And here's why I think this. So Jamie's a bad guy, a villain from the very beginning because he pushes Bran out the window, but eventually, you know, Bran lives, and we don't really know Bran yet. Cersei, that would be a late bend in her character arc. A very late bend. And on top of that, she tried to kill our favorite character. She tried to kill Tyrion. She's actively pursuing him to kill him. And it's hard for that person to be sympathetic. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, she's not... I mean, from everything I can see so far, she seems to be the least complicatable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that isn't to say that they can't pull the old bait and switch on me later, because I think we're even seeing glimpses now of, Jamie's an interesting character. Like, there's something about him, even though he's still, in my mind, he's a scoundrel and a attempted child killer, but I get the sense that there's a necessity with her, and that there's a relentlessness to her.
Yeah.
Well, and it's his choice to make, right? So I think you can pull it off if you decide you want to pull it off, and if your decision is to not pull it off, then you paint it in such a way that becomes whatever it is an inevitability.
Steve, this next question's for you. It's from Jennifer. Have you ever
used... Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for writing in, Jennifer. Have you ever used props or done impressions on stage? If so, what has worked the best for you? What hasn't worked?
In terms of impressions, you know, it's funny because this is a discussion that comes up a lot. Is I do impressions, and you know, but not on stage. I think
you
the
do
only
them for your friends. Basically.
I do them for my friends. I do a lot of impressions of like Bay Area comics. I do a lot of impressions of people like that, which, you know, you can't really do on the stage unless you're following one of them. Mm-hmm. I have on occasion, very few occasions, used a puppet.
What kind of puppet?
It's a puppet of kind of an old timey marshal.
Wait, is it like Sesame Street or?
No, it's more like I guess it would probably be more in the Muppet vein. I mean, it's a human. Okay. And he has a little soft little gun that's in a holster because you can do the hands and the head.
And what have you done with this
pup? Well, that's the gag, is I don't do anything with him. He just sits on my lap and laughs at my jokes silently.
And how has this worked for you?
The first time I did it, pretty well received, and I will say that there was a pretty good setup. I mean, the environment in which the show took place, it was pretty good crowds and a lot of comics, and I showed up late.
So you were doing this for the back of the room, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but it worked pretty well for the front of the room as well. Okay. because the context. I show up late. There was room on the list for one last. I just decided to go last. So, and I'm just wandering around the room, you know, having a drink, talking to people, and I've got this gym bag around me, and everyone's like, "What's in the bag?" I'm like, "Eh, don't worry about it." And so the anticipation between the audience and the comics was starting to build as I, you know, kind of as the room would go around, like, "Well, what is in the bag? That's a comic. What's got in the bag?" So I get up on stage and it's finally time, and everyone, and just it was crazy. Like, people were coming in from outside. People stopped playing pool.
People had to see what was in the bag.
What's in the bag? And so I pull out the puppet, and the puppet immediately gets thunderous applause just because just the idea of a puppet. And I just, I first thing I said was, I'm not a ventriloquist. And then, and then I would tell a joke.
That's how you let it. You let it with "I'm not a ventriloquist."
And then I told a joke. I let it sit for just a maybe a half beat, and then the puppet opens his mouth and starts shaking his head like he's laughing.
Yeah, see, I think this may be giving people a false impression of what your comedy is like. I would not consider you absurdist.
No.
So this was really kind of a departure, and maybe that's maybe why it worked.
I think that may have had it. And
what if the Flea Bottom one was like a like the Muppets take Flea Bottom? I'd love to see Kermit the Frog enter a tournament,
and it's super graphic. I mean, like,
to win Piggy's favor.
Yeah, and then he eats her out graphically.
Oh, Kermit.
So bad.
She wasn't kosher last night.
The best thing about this is that I didn't know you did a Miss Piggy. But it's a pretty good Miss Piggy.
And the thing is, I mean, if you're anything like me and you've gone ahead and pictured it, it's a lot like how when Cookie Monster pretends to eat a cookie.
God. the visuals, you're killing me, man.
This is for your outtakes.
I don't think we can... Honestly, I don't know if we can put that on.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
A few weeks ago, I asked a question related to the shape of Electric Boogaloo. Did you like the super nerds versus the super fan interviews? I asked about a balance between new voices and familiar voices. And I was also asking about show-only folks, if people might be just listening to the Steve portions. So not everyone agreed. However, by and large, most of you think that the scholarly voices are really what makes the podcast distinct, which is good for me because I'm an egghead, and that's what I do. So I like that portion of the podcast. I feel like getting a perspective from someone who's a specialist in gender studies or disability studies or linguism is always going to be really important. A lot of you have mentioned that you like it when I bring on the medievalists because, of course, they bring a lot to the table relative to the social and cultural background of the text. I plan on continuing to do that. And, of course, peppering in super fans like Kim Renfro and Aaron and whatnot seems to be pretty popular as well. Some of you have voiced a concern that it's difficult to keep up with the show rewatch because I don't do a synopsis for each episode. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to include a short synopsis of the episode before I begin the Steve interview. Hopefully that will enhance your experience. If it's only a few seconds, it's not going to take away from the virtue of that section, which in my view is always just to find something funny to talk about. So I will try to add that based on some of your feedback. I will mention again that subscribing, sharing an episode with a friend, shouting us out on social media, writing a review, these are all things that will help us grow. And that's all for this week.